the most controversial part of Evangelii Gaudium was its section on economics. It's what captured almost all of the headlines last November when the exhortation appeared. Pope Francis denounces market-based capitalism was one representative above the fold summary. Many of the articles, rather than focusing on all the Holy Father said about evangelization, gave most of their copy to what he said about free markets and economics. They regularly repeated some of his eyebrow-raising statements, especially those reading here in the States. Quoting Pope Francis, "Some people continue to defend trickle-down theories which assume that economic growth encouraged by a free market will inevitably succeed in bringing about greater justice and inclusiveness in the world. This opinion, which has never been confirmed by the facts, expresses a crude, naive trust in the goodness of those wielding economic power and in the sacralized workings of the prevailing economic system." A little later, "The socioeconomic system is unjust at its root." Later, "The economy of exclusion and inequality kills." Much later, "There's a need to reject the absolute autonomy of markets and financial speculation. Inequality is the root of all social ills, radix malorum. And we can no longer trust in the unseen forces in the invisible hand of the market." These were all used as weapons against even Pope John Paul II's apostolic exhortation, Centesimus Annus, from 1991. Even though elsewhere in the document, Pope Francis praised business as a noble vocation, many businessmen on our shores took what Pope Francis was saying as direct attack. Cardinal Dolan in New York said that some major donors to the capital campaign to renovate St. Patrick's Cathedral expressed serious concern and some hesitancy to follow through on their pledges and all of their efforts for the church. Some wondered how Pope Francis' words meshed with his dependence on businessmen and business consultants to revamp and lead the Vatican Bank, to reorganize Vatican communications, to examine the flow charts of Vatican dicasteries, and much more. Some theologians also wondered how some of the statements were consistent with Centesimus Annus, when Pope St. John Paul II said that the free market appears to be the most efficient instrument for utilizing resources and effectively responding to solvent needs at the level of individual nations and international relations, and that the business or market or free economy understood as an economic system that recognizes the fundamental and positive role of business, the market, private property, and the resulting responsibility for the means of production, as well as free human creativity in the economic sector, is certainly the model that ought to be proposed to the countries of the third world that are searching for the path to true economic and civil progress. What Pope Francis was not trying to do was to propose an economic model. He said very clearly that's not the Church's ambition, mission, or competence in paragraph 184. He said that his exhortation is not a social document. It's not part of the social magisterium. But he adds, the pastors have the right to offer opinions and proposals and to draw practical conclusions, lest the great social principles remain mere generalities that challenge no one. Notice the balance that he's trying to say there, which is very important for us to grasp. He's got no particular competence on, strictly speaking, economic questions. But at the same time, he's got the right and the duty to offer opinions based on faith. It's not that he shouldn't say anything there, but what he's saying here is a little bit different than the commentaries, for example, explicitly on the commandments or other parts of the Depositum Fidei. Scholars can justly question whether his critique applies more to the Gilded Age than to the present age, when especially in the United States there are very few, except anarcho-capitalists, who think that supply-side economics alone will inevitably succeed in bringing about greater justice and inclusiveness. Whether there's anybody who supports the unregulated absolute autonomy of markets and financial speculation. Whether we can find anybody from Maine to Florida to San Diego to to Washington State, who has a crude, naive trust in businessmen who believe in the unseen forces and invisible hand of the market, or in CEOs and major economic actors. And whether businessmen treat as sacred the inner workings of the economic system. There have been several scholarly articles that have made cases that Pope Francis really has in his crosshairs the crony capitalism that has destroyed the economy in Argentina since Colonel Juan Perón took over in 1946. Rather than the economic system that has led millions in China, India, Japan, Singapore, and other East Asian countries out of poverty. Or whether it implies en masse to much of our economic setup in the United States. But as important as these considerations and critiques may be, I think they're missing the point of what Pope Francis was trying to get to in the exhortation, and in many of his other statements during his papacy up until now. Even if he really had in mind just the corrupt economic system in Argentina that has led to 49% unemployment and the formation of a situation in which so many people are left behind and abandoned in poverty as a very rare few get much richer. The main lines of his moral critique apply to every situation about whether economic setups rule rather than serve. So what I want to do in this third talk is to explain where Pope Francis's words about the economy and poverty in Evangelii Gaudium fit into his missionary transformation of the church. I hope to do so in a way that will help us, whether we're poor inner city pastors or pastors of poor rural parishes, or whether we're pastors of relatively affluent suburban ones, not only to explain what Pope Francis is saying, and he's not, to our people in a way that they can understand, but also to help them respond in faith to the profound challenge he is making to all of us as disciples of Jesus, called to be apostles and share the joy of the gospel with others, beginning as Jesus did with proclaiming the gospel to the poor. This section of the document, beyond the controversy of exactly where the most critical words were meant to be applied, is really incisive to the pseudo-gods many of our people are worshiping every day. Let me just ask you a question. If at your parish, this Sunday, you were to say that some very, very rich fat cat was going to give $1 million to everyone who showed up, would your church be mobbed? Even if there were one lottery ticket for someone who was present that day to win that $1 million, you know it would still be mobbed. And yet all we really give is the creator of all the wealth in the world. And so many of our people think that there are so many more important things to be doing on the Lord's Day. Our culture does worship mammon. And that's essentially the idolatry that Pope Francis is talking about here. Because that idolatry is the hardened soil. It's the rocky soil with that thick layer of limestone 5 inches before, so that the seeds of the gospel really can't bear fruit long term. Or it's the thorns, the worldly cares and anxieties, the lure of riches that choke the growth of the seed. And Pope Francis is calling all of our attention to this aspect, because if we don't confront it, we ain't going to be able to preach the gospel effectively and carry out the new evangelization. I'd like to begin with Pope Francis' election so that we can focus a little bit on him to understand what he's doing and saying better. 3 days after the white smoke emanated from the roof of the Sistine, he met with the journalist present in Rome. I was fortunate to be there. Explained a little bit of what happened in the election and why he ended up choosing as his papal moniker the nickname of the Poverello of Assisi. He said, "Some people want to know why the Bishop of Rome wished to be called Francis. Some thought of Francis Xavier, Francis de Sales, and also Francis of Assisi. I'll tell you the story. During the election, I was seated next to the Archbishop Emeritus of São Paulo and the Prefect Emeritus of the Congregation for the Clergy, Cardinal Claudio Hamas. A good friend, a good friend. When things began to look dangerous, he encouraged me. And when the votes reached two-thirds, there was the usual applause because a new pope had been elected. He gave me a hug and a kiss, and then he said, "Non dimenticati i poveri." Don't you forget the poor. And those words came to me, and he was literally hitting his head as he said it. I poveri, i poveri, the poor, the poor. Then right away, thinking of the poor, I thought of Francis of Assisi. That's how the name came in my heart. Francis of Assisi. For me, he's a man of poverty. How I would like a church which is poor and for the poor. In one of the interviews, actually, with a close friend of his in a book published by Alejandro Bermudez, which is really quite good. When he was second in the 2005 conclave, the thought had come to his mind of what name he would choose. You may have read it, this book. He was going to choose John the 24th because of his great love for Angelo Roncalli. It seems that the first time he had ever thought of the name Francis was after that conversation with Cardinal Hummus. It was right then. He hadn't given any thought to it up until that point. Because of Pope Francis' specific spiritual poverty, because of the incredible treasure of the kingdom. And what he wants is a chiesa povera per i poveri, a poor church for the poor. This is not a new thought in terms of the poor church for the poor for Cardinal Bergoglio. Cardinal Hummus was reminding him of something that he really saw in a Aparecida and had known over the course of time. This is something essential to Cardinal Jorge Bergoglio's whole life as a priest and a bishop. In order to grasp what the missionary transformation of the church really means for him, in order to capture what he's saying when he's calling the church to get outside of sick self-referential maintenance to take Christ's mission to those in the existential peripheries, it's useful to see what he did in Argentina with the sprawling slums all around Buenos Aires called the Villas Miserias, the misery barrios. There are 20 of these slums in which most of the people are forgotten, where drug dealers and local mafia dons and gangs rule, and police normally stay out. Each of them has the population of small cities. Most of the villas are simply called by a number rather than by a name of a neighborhood because they have no identity. When Jorge Bergoglio became archbishop, there were only 6 heroic priests who were living in these bad neighborhoods, despite the obvious pastoral need. You know, when you hear some of his early criticisms of the priesthood, I think you need to hear that he struggled as an archbishop to get guys to take these assignments. None of the priests wanted to go. So he changed the way seminary formation was done, so that nobody would be ordained unless he was willing to take an assignment, because that's where many of the people were, starving for the gospel. There were only 6 priests, and he struggled to get anybody to go. So he began to lead by example, taking the bus there himself, walking the streets, entering homes, celebrating masses for the prostitutes, visiting AIDS patients, keeping contact with the families of the desaparecidos, all of those kidnapped people whose identity still, whose whereabouts we still don't know. Confirming all the children one by one, even 450 children at a time. His hand was probably sagging like St. Francis Xavier's there because of all the work on a given day. Taking photos with the families, drinking mate with them, talking to people about the books they were reading, showing them that even though many in society, and particularly in the government, had forgotten about them, he and the church hadn't. Even though most were treating them like an existential garbage heap, the church was treating him as a treasure, like St. Lawrence treated the poor in Rome. Cardinal Bergoglio recognized that drugs and violence were both symptoms of the same disease. And what was the disease? It was marginalization. Marginalization of a life from God, from others, from a society as a whole. And he wanted to replace that culture of exclusion with one of encounter. As one priest who was sent there said to journalist John Allen, basically what society is telling these people is, we don't want you to exist. And the work Cardinal Bergoglio started here is to try to tell them instead, it's good that you exist. Eventually, Cardinal Bergoglio started personally asking priests to take those difficult assignments, change seminary formation so that they'd take them rather than the cozier ones with fixed rectory staff and the like. By the time he had left, he had quadrupled the number of curas fieros, those priests who were sharing the life of the people down to its minute details. The priests who worked there say that it was in the Vias Miserias that the future Pope Francis began to crystallize his thinking about how the church needs to be poor and for the poor, about how to cure their worst poverty, their spiritual poverty, but also how to help them fight drugs and violence, to receive an education and provide job training and means of self-sufficiency, to help the elderly and to give the people the voice. His great model for all of this was St. John Bosco, his work in Turin with all the street kids. St. John Bosco was founding technical training schools to help them get jobs. He was doing things to entertain them, to keep them from getting into trouble, from giving them some type of hope. And that's what Cardinal Bergoglio was trying to catalyze. The people of these Vias Miserias now call him El Papa de las Vias, the Pope of the Vias, treating him as one of them. And he personally is trying to set that example of living poor for the poor. We can see as a priest, bishop, and now as Pope, how he has always lived with a spirit of poverty. Not just to identify with the poor, but to be able to accompany them. He didn't live in the fabulous Archbishop's residence, Buenos Aires, near the presidential palace, but lived in a simple apartment near the cathedral, cooking his own noodles, eschewing a car and a driver in order to take public transportation, not buying his cardinal vestments, but having the cassock of his very, very, very rotund predecessor tailored to fit him. His choice is about his own place to live and the car in which he is transported now. Continue not just the symbolism of poverty, but the actual life of simplicity toward which he's summoning the whole church to emulate. He's called us priests explicitly to become living examples of the first beatitude for all the people to see, so that they'd be able to grasp what poverty of spirit is and how it leads to the joy of the kingdom of God. Last July, when he was speaking to seminarians and novices, he said, "To be joyful witnesses of the gospel, it's necessary to be authentic and consistent. In this world to which wealth does so much damage, it's necessary that we priests, that we sisters, that all of us be consistent with our poverty. But when you find that money is the principal concern of an educational parochial or indeed any other institution, this isn't good. It's not good. It's an inconsistency. We must have integrity and be authentic. On this route, let us do what St. Francis says. Preach the gospel with our example and then with words. It's in our life that others must first be able to read the gospel." He added, "Some will say today, joy is born from possessions. So they go in quest of the latest model of the smartphone, the fastest scooter, the showiest car. But I tell you, it truly grieves me to see a priest or a sister with the latest model of a car. This can't be. It can't be. Cars are obviously necessary because there's so much work to be done. We need to get about. But choose a more humble car. And if you like the beautiful one, think of the children who are dying of hunger. That's all. Joy is not born from, it doesn't come from the things we possess. And we, priests and religious," he says, "need to show that before we ever say it." Now, it's that echo of what he said earlier and elsewhere in the exhortation. What would it look like if we actually took Jesus' words in the Beatitudes seriously? Right? This is the great contradiction. The world says you have to be rich to be happy. Jesus says we need to be poor in spirit. What's it going to be? world says you have to have all your sexual fantasies fulfilled. Jesus says you need to be pure in heart. What's it going to be? Jesus says, blessed are you. The world says, blessed are you when you finish fights that other people start. When you teach people lessons that they'll never forget. Where they'll never even contemplate crossing you in the least way again. Jesus says, rather blessed are the meek, blessed are the peacemakers. The world says, blessed are you when you're the life of the party, when you voted Miss Congeniality, most popular in your senior class. Jesus, blessed are you when they hate your guts because of me. What's it going to be? Are we on the broad road of the world and rejecting the Beatitudes? Or are we walking that narrow road, the road in which Jesus enfleshed the Beatitudes and called us to become living exegetes of that commentary? And it all starts with our spiritual poverty. Pope Francis is saying, if we're going to help the world overcome its idolatry of mammon, we've got to show there's a better way. This is a particularly challenging point for us priests in the United States. You know, when missionaries come here from other countries, they're shocked that even the diocese that has the least remuneration for priests is about 10 times what they get elsewhere. A lot of the times they want to become preferential missionaries to the United States for that reason, right? A lot of the, you know, we can do pretty well for ourselves sometimes. It can scandalize the others. Pope Francis is calling us to be able to do more. He's trying to summon us by his own example, to show that we're seeking first and above all the kingdom of heaven, that if our whole life is meant to be a commentary on the words of consecration, this is my body, this is my blood, this is my wallet and my credit cards, all that I have given out of love for you, that people are going to see it. You know, we know how much of a countersign or celibacy is in a world that's addicted to sexuality. But in a world that's also enslaved to mammon, the spiritual poverty is essential. That's one of the things Pope Francis is calling us to here. Let's examine where the section on poverty in the economy fits into Evangelii Gaudium. Pope Francis writes that care for the poor is a fruit of the evangelization of individuals and societies. That to form someone in the life of the gospel, to unite someone to Jesus as a living member of his body, to allow them to enter into the life of the communion of persons who is our triune God, that all of this must have consequences in the way we relate to others, especially the poor. Paragraph 176, he says, to evangelize is to make the kingdom of God present in the world. And that kingdom is one in which we are spiritually poor, treasuring God above all. And we can't do it if we're weighed down like the rich young man and we can't let go of our stuff. Says a little later, the kerygma has a clear social content. At the very heart of the gospel is life in community and engagement with others. The content of the first proclamation has an immediate moral implication centered on charity. Our redemption is a social dimension because God in Christ redeems not only the individual person, but all social relations existing between men. The mystery of the Trinity reminds us that we have been created in the image of that divine communion. From the heart of the gospel, we see the profound connection between evangelization and human advancement, which must necessarily find expression and develop in every work of evangelization. Accepting that first proclamation, which invites us to receive God's love and to love Him in return with the very love which is His gift, brings forth in our life and actions a primary and fundamental response to desire, seek, and protect the good of others. He focuses on the early church, right? What do we see in the early church? Everybody was selling all they had, giving to the money to be distributed to those who most needed. Now, within our lifetime, somebody would say that was crypto-communism. It wasn't. It wasn't being confiscated. It was being freely given. That's the type of sacrifice that happens normally. We all know it. In loving families, when people begin to treat each other as family members rather than as total strangers. I've always been very moved. I was a guide to St. Peter Scavi and then the Basilica of St. Peter for many years. Many of you have been there, celebrated Mass there. That the altar that faces us as soon as we exit from the sacristy to go someplace to celebrate Mass is the scene of Ananias and Sapphira from the Acts of the Apostles. Church doesn't even give us the chance once, even in the daily Mass lectionary, to be able to preach about this. How come? Because we could manipulate it a lot, right? You remember the story. After Joseph Barnabas sells all that he has and lays the proceeds at the feet of the apostle, Ananias and Sapphira sell their fields but keep some of it to themselves. When Ananias brings the sacrifice to Peter, Peter says, "Why are you lying to the Holy Spirit?" Dead. They bring him to the cemetery. Sapphira comes and says, "Where's my honey?" And they say, "Behold the funeral procession, and they're ready for you." Gone. Now, why doesn't the church trust us to preach on that? Could you imagine what you could do in a capital campaign preaching on that or something? But why is it there? You know, one of the great interpretive keys for churches that take 120 years to build, as the upstairs Basilica of St. Peter did, was that things are where they are for a reason. What's the reason why that mosaic awaits every priest as he's going to celebrate Mass in the Basilica? To remind us that on the day of ordination, we lay down and we died. The old rites that cover us with a funeral pall, at least in religious life, to show that we were dead. Part of that would be a new religious name. Part of it is symbolized by St. Ignatius and others in the black clothes we wear to proclaim our own death, not just the Lord's. So the Lord is really living in us. And it's there so that we remember that sacrifice and don't spend our priesthood trying to take back what we've already given away. Right? We're supposed to be totally given, total gifts for others, including with our stuff. But some of the times our stuff can own us rather than the other way around. In paragraph 181, he says, "Reading the scriptures, it makes clear that the gospel is not just about our personal relationship with God. Nor should our loving response to God be seen clearly in an accumulation of small personal gestures to individuals in need. A kind of charity a la carte, or a series of acts aimed solely at easing our conscience. The gospel is about the kingdom of God. It's about loving God who reigns in our world. To the extent that He reigns within us, the life of society will be a setting for universal fraternity, justice, peace, and dignity. Our Christian preaching and our life are meant to have an impact on society." That's the real meaning of social justice, as we take it out, that the leaven changes the world. That we care about the poor. That we recognize that they're all family members. And if someone's in need, we give them greater concern. Calls us to, like God, hear the cry of the poor. To respond differently than our self-centered, hedonistic pagan culture does to the poor, allowing them to remain on the periphery. He says, "This message is so clear and direct, so simple and eloquent, that no ecclesial interpretation has the right to relativize it." Many times we do. "Well, the poor we'll always have with us. I don't have to work all that urgently." It says, "For the church, the option for the poor is primarily a theological category rather than a cultural, sociological, political, or philosophical one." What does he mean by that? To say it's a theological category, theologos, means that God speaks to us about the poor and through the poor. And when we're listening to the cries of the poor, we're listening to God speaking. It's primarily a theological category. A lot of times we don't look at it that way. We look at it fundamentally as a financial or sociological category. He's calling us to a new listening and to a new vision. He says, "This is why I want a church which is poor and for the poor. Because the church has much to teach us. God has much to teach us through them. Not only do they share in the sensus fidei, but in their difficulties they know the suffering Christ. We need to let ourselves be evangelized by them. The new evangelization is an invitation to acknowledge the saving power at work in their lives and to put them at the center of the church's pilgrim way. We're called to find Christ in them, to lend our voice to their causes, to be their friends, to listen to them, to speak for them, and to embrace the mysterious wisdom that God wishes to share with us through them. When we care for the poor, we receive far more than we give, is what he's saying. One of the reasons why many of us are spiritually impoverished is because we're not close enough to the poor. Many of you, I don't know if the Missionaries of Charity are in the Diocese of Winona, are they? One of the great joys in my life has been to accompany the Missionaries of Charity in various countries, their work, and to preach retreats to them and everything else. It's always a thing of massive conversion for me when I'm close to them. It relativizes all that I think is really important. And I come back always thoroughly refreshed. I haven't slept very much. I haven't eaten quite as well. But I come back profoundly changed. There's one story of Mother Teresa which is true about her work in Guatemala. The sisters introduced her to this woman, and Mother Teresa saw that this woman was so full of joy. So she was talking to the sisters about what the secret of this woman was. And the sister said, "Why don't you ask her, Mother?" So Mother asked her. She responded, "Porque tengo en mi casa el profesor de amor," because I have in my house the professor of love. Mother was wondering first if she had the Blessed Sacrament in her house for some reason. She didn't know who is this professor of love, Mother replied. And the mom said, "Come and see." So Mother Teresa visited her home. And inside, that's only the second room in this house, was the most mangled kid Mother said she had ever seen. She had seen many. All types of physical maladies and etc. The kid was retarded, but he was also very, very much deformed. And Mother said, "This is the professor of love." "Yes, Mother." Mother's never ceased to talk about that story, that the caring of the mother for that child was, in all the child's multiple instances of poverty, was really what transformed this mother to be a truly joyful disciple. As we abort 90% of those with Down syndrome today, we're becoming more and more like ancient Sparta, which for all its strength disintegrated from within because it failed to be human. Probably been to the Holocaust Museum in D.C., where down that staircase you've got Chaim Ganot's words up there. "Dear teacher," I'm not going to be able to give the whole quotation, but "I was a witness of concentration camps. I saw them built by learned engineers. Lots of doctors, learned doctors, everything else. Please don't become like them. Please teach your children to be truly human, so that they don't become other educated Eichmanns." One of our greatest teachers are the poor, those who are in need. Helps us to appreciate the really good things. Helps us to learn how to rejoice in what we have rather than complain about what we have not. That's what Pope Francis is getting to here. What's his critique of our culture? There are several parts of the critique of his soil sample in Western cultures particularly. The first critique is consumerism. He says, "The great danger in today's world, pervaded as it is by consumerism, is the desolation and anguish born of a complacent yet covetous heart, the feverish pursuit of frivolous pleasures, and a blunted conscience. Whenever our interior life becomes caught up in its own interests and concerns, there's no longer room for anybody else, no place for the poor. God's voice is no longer heard. The quiet joy of His love is no longer felt, and the desire to do good fades. This is a real danger for believers. Many fall prey to it and end up resentful, angry, and listless." We see that this also invades the church, right? Many of you have probably read Father Michael White's and Tom Corcoran's book, Reguilt, right? And it all starts by an analysis of many of the people sitting in our pews are demanding consumers. They've taken that spirituality of Madison Avenue into our churches. And we need something different. That consumerism is a cancer that has many metastatic daughters. One is an economy of exclusion. Pope Francis says, just as the commandment, thou shalt not kill, sets a clear limit in order to safeguard the value of human life, today we also have to say, thou shalt not, to an economy of exclusion and inequality. Such an economy kills. And he gives an example. How can it be that it's not a news item when an elderly person who's homeless dies of exposure, but it is news when the stock market loses 2 points? Many times he's used a rabbinical tale of the building of the Tower of Babel. Last year, when he was meeting with kids in Jesuit schools, he said, I once read a story about a medieval rabbi in the year 1200. The rabbi explained to the Jews that at the time of the building of the Tower of Babel, it wasn't easy. They had to make the bricks. And how is a brick made? Mud and straw must be fetched. They must be mixed, and the bricks brought to the kiln, and involved a lot of work. And after this, a brick became a real treasure. They then had to hoist the bricks in order to build the tower. If a brick fell, it was a tragedy. But if a man fell, nobody cared. It's the crisis that we're living today. The same crisis. It's the crisis of the person. Today the person counts for nothing. It's coins, it's money that count. Again, there's real validity here. Whole thing about the stock market. It's the marginalization of the unproductive on the extremes of life, right? The elderly who can no longer work, the young before they can work, especially those who don't seem to have much potential. Within this context comes his criticism of trickle-down economic theory. Part of this is based on a bad translation in the English, but there's something there too. It says some people continue to defend trickle-down theories, which assume that it should translate the word all there, which wasn't in the English. Economic growth encouraged by a free market will inevitably, the real translation is, by itself alone, succeed in bringing about greater justice and inclusiveness in the world. There's nobody who really defends that. But the main point he wants to make is not economic analysis, but moral. He says, to sustain a lifestyle that excludes others, or to sustain enthusiasm for that selfish ideal, leads to a globalization of indifference. Almost without being aware of it, we end up being incapable of feeling compassion at the outcry of the poor, of weeping for other people's pain, of feeling a need to help them, as though all of this was somebody else's responsibility instead of our own. The culture of prosperity is deadening us. We're thrilled if the market offers us something new to purchase. But in the meantime, all of those lives are stunted for lack of opportunity, and they seem such a mere spectacle. They fail to move us. Where this was most powerfully expressed was last July 7th when he went to Lampedusa. I'd venture to guess none of us here had ever heard of Lampedusa before the Pope went. It's this tiny little island off the coast of Sicily, where over the last 20 years, 25,000 people have perished trying to get mainly from Christian areas in North Africa, fleeing poverty and persecution to Europe. In boats that are fit for 20 people, they stack about 150. The coyote prices are the equivalent of U.S. dollars 40,000. Just think about this for the people of Eritrea and Ethiopia. 40,000. And 25,000 have perished on that route. And right before the Pope went last year, one of the boats capsized. And there were rocks on the southern shore of Lampedusa. And the boats were crushing the people against the rocks, including a nine-month pregnant woman. So Pope Francis went there to say this can't continue to happen. He said, today no one in our world feels responsible. We've lost a sense of responsibility for our brothers and sisters. We've fallen into the hypocrisy of the priest and the Levite whom Jesus described in the parable of the Good Samaritan. We see our brother half dead on the side of the road, and perhaps we say, poor fella. But then we go on our way. It's not our responsibility. With that we feel reassured, assuaged. The culture of comfort, which makes us think only of ourselves, makes us insensitive to the cries of other people. It leaves us indifferent to others. In fact, it leads to a globalization of indifference. In this globalized world, we've fallen into globalized indifference. We've become used to the suffering of others. It no longer affects us. It doesn't concern us. We think it's none of our business. You know, he told a story there. He used to teach literature, you know, as a high school professor, about a book by Lopez de Vega. In one of those books, he talked about a place called Fuente Ovejuna, the well where the sheep would drink. He said there was a tyrant there, and the people got up and they killed the governor. And so when the investigators came to investigate the murder, they asked, who killed? And the governor was executed in a way that nobody really knew who had given the lethal blow. So when they were asking, who killed the governor? Everybody was responding, Fuente Ovejuna, senor. It was the city who killed him. Everybody killed him, and nobody killed him. He said, we've become like a worldwide Fuente Ovejuna. No one's responsible for the death of our brothers and sisters in Lampedusa. No one's responsible for the death of our brothers and sisters in Iraq. Nobody's responsible for the death of our brothers and sisters by the Boko Haram. Nobody's responsible for the death of our brothers and sisters dying of starvation in various places. We all think it's somebody else's problem. And that's totally contrary to the kingdom, Pope Francis says. At the Syria vigil last September 7th, he said, God's world is a world in which everyone feels responsible for the other, for the good of the other. Is this really the world I desire? Is this really the world I'm carrying in my heart? Is this the world in which we're living? It would be good for us to ask ourselves, am I really my brother's keeper? In order for that to occur, he says, we have to overcome, indeed smash, the ferocious idolatry of money. He says in paragraph 55 that we've created today new idols. We're worshipping anew the ancient golden calf. In an interview in Portuguese in Brazil last summer, he said the world in which we're living has fallen into a ferocious idolatry of money. It's the word for wolf, right? Eating us alive. It's preying upon us. There's a worldwide policy dominated by the pursuit of money. What's in control now is money. What's happening as a result? When this world of the ferocious idolatry of money reigns, everything focuses for the most part on the center. Those in the extreme of society, the young who don't work yet, seniors who are too old to work, the handicapped who can't work, are badly taken care of, neglected, and discarded. Exactly a year ago today, he was in Sardinia, in Cagliari, stressing that this endangers our future. An economic system that leads to this tragedy, centered on an idol called money, kills us. To defend this idol, all crowd to the center, and those in the margins are done down. The elderly fall away, because there's no room for them in this world. The ferocious idolatry of money leads to a hidden euthanasia, leads to a new tyranny. It produces a financial system that rules rather than serves, because it's lost a sense of God and what his expectations are for all of us, because God's a threat. He says the charity should rule, not profit. A lot of the times people don't want to hear that. It's considered dangerous. And this practical atheism in the economic sphere spawns this general spiritual worldliness even among believers. 7 days before he was elected, in his speech to the general congregation of his brother cardinals, he said, quoting Henri de Lubac, his fellow Jesuit, that the worst evil that can afflict us in the church is spiritual worldliness. That's a category from Ignatius' spiritual exercises, right, on which he had pondered very much over the course of all the exercises he had preached. But spiritual worldliness is the worst evil that can beset the church. And it leads us to living only to give ourselves glory rather than God. Leads to our living by a spirit of the world rather than the spirit of Jesus. The church becomes an institution, an enterprise. She ceases to be a bride and ends up being an administrator. From being a servant, a handmaid, she becomes an inspector. He goes on to describe that in paragraphs 93 and following. We're running out of time, so I'm not really going to be able to focus on it. But spiritual worldliness means we make mammon, and we place in mammon our faith, hope, and love. This worldly stuff. He calls it a self-absorbed Promethean neo-Pelagianism. Notice that he's following his own principles of using vocabulary everybody can understand. Self-absorbed, right, and self-referential. Promethean, meaning God had given, the gods in ancient Greek, had Zeus had given Prometheus fire. But he began to treat the fire as it were, as if it were his own, rather than that he was a servant of what God had given. And Neo-Pelagianism, focusing just on his own works rather than responding to grace. That's what spiritual worldliness leads to. We forget grace. We forget God. We just start focusing on ourselves. And eventually, this starts as a cancer to affect everything else. It leads to a business mentality. We get caught up with management, stats, and evaluations, whose principal beneficiary is not God's people, but the church as an institution. This is a tremendous corruption, he said, disguised as a good sometimes. Now, what Cardinal Pell said a couple weeks ago in an interview, who was brought in from Australia to be the Pope's financial czar to renovate everything, he said a point that's very, very important. When Edward Penton asked him, "Are you the Pope's number one guy?" He says, "No, and I'll never be." He said, there's an important reason for that. Because the economic stuff isn't the most important stuff for the church. It's important, but it's not the most important. So my office, whoever succeeds me, is never going to be the Pope's right-hand guy. He said, we need money. Because the Good Samaritan would have never been able to help the guy left in a ditch if he couldn't afford the inn. But it's not the primary thing. It's not primary. I want to finish with some thoughts from the new Archbishop Designate of Chicago. In June, in Washington, he gave a little reflection that in the last 2 days has been getting a lot more attention. And I think he framed accurately what Pope Francis was trying to do in this section of the exhortation. He said it was fundamentally about anthropology, about a theological anthropology, much more than economics. He gave his remarks in a conference contrasting what Pope Francis is calling us to radical libertarianism. Now, I don't think that there are many radical libertarians out there who are in control in places. But nevertheless, the critique of radical libertarianism applies much more broadly. I think it's all accurate. The vision of Pope Francis and the vision of his libertarian critics, Archbishop Supich said, constitute two compellingly different pathways for humanity at this moment in history. These conflicting pathways are based on two utterly divergent conceptions on the nature of the human person. Human dignity anchors, he first praises some of the libertarian ideas, saying that they share with Catholic social teaching respect for human dignity, anchoring their insistence on human freedom. They rightly argue that this dignity is not given by society but by the Creator, and therefore freedom, self-determination, all of the human rights are inalienable, echoing the principles in the documents of democracy. However, Archbishop Supich says, they stop short in considering what this means. Since the dignity belongs to all human beings in common, it implies solidarity of all peoples. By uncoupling human dignity from the solidarity implied, libertarians move in a direction that not only has enormous consequences for the meaning of economic life and the goals of politics in a world of globalization, but in a direction that's inconsistent with Catholic social teaching, particularly as developed by Pope Francis. Then he said, let me put this more sharply. For Francis, the human person seeks and claims an integral development morally, spiritually, and emotionally, which is joined intrinsically to the communities that sustain him. For the Pope's libertarian critics, the human person is an autonomous individual, man qua producer and consumer. For Francis, inclusion and economic security for all are measures of economic health, in contrast to the one-dimensional measure of economic growth proposed by his critics for decision-making in the age of globalization, meaning profit. For Francis, politics seeks the common good. For his libertarian critics, politics seeks to maximize the freedom of markets and individual choice. For Francis, the strength of globalization leads to the need for global structures that help mold the forces of market capitalism to advance solidarity and dignity for all. For libertarians, market forces left to themselves are the best arbiters of economic progress. Pope Francis, Archbishop Supich concluded, is not interested in providing an economic plan or system. Rather, his first goal is to call believers, call us all, to renewed encounter with the risen Christ, so that our lives may be marked by a joy that sets us free from sorrow, sin, inner emptiness, and loneliness, to the point that we're compelled to invite others to enter into and participate in that same encounter, life and joy. Everything else for the believer is relative. Everything else, our economy, politics, social programs, our lifestyles, are all measured by how they help or hinder others in participating in this encounter with God. This life God has destined for humanity and in experiencing God's loving encounter. The Pope isn't asking us to give our wallets, but to give over our lives to bring about the kingdom of God in our midst. He's not describing adopting an economic system that stifles personal initiative and creativity. Nor, for that matter, is it about baptizing a market economy to the point that it sends a message, especially to our youth, that it's okay to organize your life around trying to make as much money as you can, as long as you're occasionally generous to the needy. No, the Pope's invitation is much more profound. Is sharing with others the joy of our encounter with Christ our priority? And specifically, when it comes to inviting the poor to participate in the life God is calling us all to share, we have to deal with their real life situation, not only that they're in want, but that they're excluded. It's within this context that he calls for a shift from an economics of exclusion to a culture of encounter and the need for accompaniment. It's all about anthropology. Economics was always taxonomically placed in the realm of moral theology because our interactions with others are profoundly moral. Let's finish. Pope Francis said, "If anyone feels offended by my words, I'd respond that I'm speaking them with affection and with the best of intentions, quite apart from any personal interest or political ideology. My words are not those of a foe or an opponent. I'm interested only in helping those who are enthralled to an individual, indifferent, and self-centered mentality to be freed from those unworthy chains, to attain a way of life and thinking which is more humane, noble, and fruitful, which will bring dignity to their presence on earth." He added, "I fear that these words, too, may give rise to commentary or discussion with no real practical consequences. That being said, I trust in the openness and readiness of all Christians, and I ask you," it'd be saying in a fortiori to all of us as his brother priests, "I ask you to seek, as a community, creative ways of accepting this renewed call." He's hoping that we will lead this charge and change in cooperation and response to God's grace, saying, "Any church community, if it thinks it can comfortably go its own way without creative concern and effective cooperation in helping the poor to live with dignity and reaching out to everyone, will also risk breaking down, however much it may talk about social issues or criticize governments. It will easily drift into the spiritual worldliness camouflaged by religious practices, unproductive meetings, and empty talk." His reform of the church as a whole involves a reform of the church so that we will be una chiesa povera per I poveri, a poor church for the poor, so that we may all give better witness to the treasure of heaven, to that pearl of great price, to Jesus who himself chose to be poor, to enrich us with his own poverty, and then joyfully turns to all of us and says, "First, come follow me down this road, and then go. Go to the whole world, even to the extremes and peripheries, and proclaim this gospel, teaching others to carry out everything I have commanded you." And Jesus never calls us to anything unless he's prepared to give us all the help he knows we need to do it. Through his earthly vicar, he's trying to give us some of that assistance. Praise be Jesus Christ.